He encouraged Angolans and all Africans to seek peace, reconciliation, and to rebuild the continent's frail democratic institutions. Pope Benedict made no mention of condoms and HIV after stoking controversy earlier this week. His comments saying condoms were not a solution and could even worsen the pandemic, which has hit the continent so hard, has been widely criticized in and outside Africa. NPR News, Luanda.
The African Union suspended Madagascar as a member today, saying its change in government this week was the same as a coup. The president had resigned Tuesday after months of protests and placed the country in the hands of the military. The African Union is giving Madagascar 6 months to organize elections or face possible sanctions. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Overture Films, presenting Sunshine Cleaning, starring Amy Adams, Emily Blunt, and Alan Arkin. Now playing in select theaters.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Songs of Ascension by Meredith Monk and Vocal Ensemble with visual elements by Ann Hamilton on Saturday, April 4th. More information is available online at krannertcenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And once a month on a Friday, he stops by here and we talk about money management. He begins by making some comments. Sometimes it's about what's happening with the economy. Maybe sometimes it's a specific kind of investment topic that he talks a little bit about. And then if you have questions on that, but anything else, he will do his best to help you out. So you're thinking about what you're going to do with your money and you need a little bit of advice, he can help you. So that's what we're doing here. Glad to have you back.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to begin this morning by answering a question that was posed on last month's program. Basically, the question that was asked was, what happened to all the money in the economy with the meltdown of real estate and real estate mortgages? In other words, someone purchased those mortgages with cash dollars, and even though many mortgages, well, they've defaulted, they've burned, and are even worthless, doesn't the cash still exist? And isn't it somehow sloshing around in our economy? Well, the answer to the question is clearly yes, the money still does exist. And this question actually raises the issue of something we really haven't talked about in a very long time, called money supply and its impact on the overall economy and indeed on our own spending habits. Now, in economic terms, money supply is really the total amount of money sort of sloshing around. It's available in the economy at any particular point in time. And there are several ways, of course, to define money, but I usually like to define it as really the money in circulation. That's those dollar bills, $20 bills, $5 bills, and in your case, David, those hundreds and thousand dollar bills, and even some of that jingling coin, along with demand deposits. And demand deposits, what we're really referring to here, for the most part, are checking accounts. And money supply data, of course, are recorded, it's published, usually by the government or indeed the central bank of a country. And public and private sector analysts have long monitored the changes in the supply of money because it has impacts on inflation. It has impacts on pricing levels. It has impacts indeed on the GDP and even our own business and economic cycles. And the relationship between money and prices is historically associated with really how much money is sloshing around in the economy. And indeed, there is very strong empirical evidence of a direct relationship between the long-term pricing of assets, in other words, inflation in our economy, and the growth in the money supply. And these factors really underlie the current reliance on monetary policy as a means of controlling inflation and really dealing with what we have now is the eroding of prices, that is, deflation. Now, recently, our Federal Reserve, and more particularly its chairman, Ben Bernanke, have been very active in the terms of monetary policy, money supply, etc., trying to deal with falling prices, not only in America, but globally. First, the Federal Reserve has been pushing down interest rates by establishing the target Fed funds interest rate at almost 0 to 0.25%, which is an historic low. Now, the Fed funds rate, as we've talked about before, is really the rate at which banks borrow from each other overnight, depending upon their reserve requirements. However, recently, as we all know, banks just haven't been borrowing money from each other overnight, and indeed, banks won't lend to each other overnight because they fear the balance sheets of other banks. The theory is, of course, that when bank rates are low, when banks can borrow money very, very cheaply, then low rates will be passed on to you and I, spurring us to borrow money because of the attractive interest rate, and thereby spend money, jump-starting our economy with purchases. And second, for the first time in our history of the Federal Reserve, its chairman, again, Mr. Bernanke, actually appeared, well, earlier this week on national television. It was last Sunday. Millions and millions of Americans watched Mr. Bernanke on 60 Minutes, and he gave a, well, I would call it a rather calming performance about the state of our economy, and even suggested a possible end to the recession very late this year. And indeed, on Monday, Tuesday, and actually into Wednesday, stocks seemed to react rather positively. Now, this public relations action by the Federal Reserve is really unprecedented. This has never happened in the history of the Federal Reserve, where someone, indeed the chairman, goes on television and sort of gives a mini interview. And third, just 2 days ago, the Federal Reserve announced it would buy back hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. treasuries and literally perhaps as much as a trillion of mortgage securities. And they would buy these securities back with what? Well, newly printed dollars. So in other words, I'm going to give back my security at maturity, and I'm going to get these newly beautiful pieces of currency. So we're going to have more dollars, essentially, sloshing around in our economy. This action, again, is an attempt to spur economic activities, because Americans like you and I, if we own these treasuries or these securities, well, we'll now have dollars in our pocket, dollars to spend, and even banks will have more dollars to loan as these instruments mature. Now, historically, when more dollars are sloshing around in our economy, there indeed is more economic activity. We seem to spend more of these dollars, and prices of just about everything rise. And that is what is really going on here. In other words, by having more dollars available in the economy, the Fed is hoping more people are going to go out and buy real estate with those dollars and stabilize, for example, real estate prices. They're going to go out and buy more goods, which means that we need to increase our very underutilized industrial capacity, which exists in this country. It's at historic lows, and put more people back to work. The theory being that economic activity will increase, prices will rise, and this current deflationary spiral, this erosion of value, will finally end. Of course, it's important to differentiate between the total cash that we have in an economy and at the same time how wealthy all of us feel and how likely we are to spend money. So, for example, so many people have suffered tremendous losses of their net worth due to falling home prices and this gut-wrenching stock market. Banks, financial institutions, and even insurance companies have suffered trillions of dollars of losses on the value of all kinds of securities they hold. So as a result, while there may be more cash sloshing around in the economy, people just aren't prone to be spending as yet. In fact, they are actually hoarding their cash, and they are putting in savings. So for example, if we looked at national money markets today, there's more than $4 trillion of money sitting in those money markets earning practically nothing. Isn't that interesting? So Interestingly enough, one of the more positive results, however, of the Fed action, in spite of our increase in savings, and we're starting to pay off some of our debts, well, are the historic low mortgage rates currently available. For example, 30-year rates as of yesterday's close approximate 5%, and 15-year mortgage rates are now well below 5 in the 4.5 to 4.75 category. Many economists believe these rates will eventually reach 4% or lower through the Fed's buying back securities, putting more money out there, keeping interest rates at their historic lows. Now, of course, it's important to recognize that these rates are generally available only to the most creditworthy of customers and borrowers, which really means your credit score, if you check it, needs to be about 740 or higher. And additionally, let's not forget about another freebie out there, about the $8,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers who actually move in to a newly purchased house this year and do not sell that house for at least 3 years. These folks will actually receive either a cash refund or an $8,000 tax credit against taxes owing when they file their 2009 personal income tax return in April of 2010. Either way, it's a real $8,000. So, for a first-time home buyer, looking at a $150,000 purchase price, the government is essentially, that's us, subsidizing the purchase price by $8,000 or more than 5% of the purchase price. So if you went out and bought today, even if housing prices fell an additional 5% on your $150,000 purchase for this first-time home buyer, you're still delta neutral, and probably you would be ahead. That's a pretty handsome deal, at least in my estimation. Now, remember that, again, you must purchase the home this year. So bottom line, it's probably a reasonable time to purchase a house, or at least consider it, especially when we look at the mortgage interest rates that are available for 30-year and 15-year amortizations. By the way, if you are sitting in an adjustable-rate mortgage, which is coming due, or you have a high mortgage interest rate and you have a credit score of 740 or better, don't sit on the sidelines any longer. Refinance that mortgage. Don't take additional money out. Just simply refinance it at the current principal outstanding loan value. Okay, let's change topics for a moment and examine our couch potato portfolio, which consists of 8 stock indexes. I understand that it's been updated today, so you can find the portfolio on the WLL website. Obviously, you click on Focus 580, you click on Links, and then you eventually click on Couch Potato Portfolio. Through yesterday's close, I wish I had better news. Our portfolio is negative about 14.6% for the year, while our benchmark S&P 500 index is a negative 12.6% for the year. So once again, our diversified portfolio, it hasn't been rewarded for being diversified. It is actually trailing the S&P 500 by approximately 2%. So we are slowly narrowing the gap between our portfolio and just our benchmark S&P, because if you'll recall last month, our portfolio was actually trailing in excess of 4%. So we've cut that deficit in half. So there you have it, David. I'd be happy to talk about interest rates, mortgage rates, perhaps the Fed Reserve, the stock market, or other financial planning tools and topics that's on our listeners' minds.
All right. And I want to also remind people that if you want to look at the Couch Potato portfolio, what you'll need to do is go to the older version of our website. It's there, and that is WILL.UIUC.EDU, and you will be able to find it. And also some of our other links there. In fact, our Doyle Moore recipes are there, a bunch of other
lots
stuff
of great
is,
links.
Is there.
Good lots stuff of great there. Links.
All right. Well, our guest is David Sinnoh. He's a professor, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management. And if you have questions, they're welcome. We have several folks who are ready to go. And we'll start with someone in St. Joe and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I've seen on various properties the designation LLC associated with it. Can you tell me what LLC stands for and what it does, what happens?
I'd be happy to. LLC stands for Limited Liability Company. It is a specific way of titling ownership in real estate or, indeed, owning a business. Now, it sort of works like a combination of a corporation and a partnership. For tax purposes, an LLC is taxed as a partnership, which means that all of the income, the profits, or indeed the losses flow through directly to the partnership and to the individuals who own the LLC. Thus, there is no double taxation like a corporation, where a corporation is taxed and then the shareholders are taxed on dividends. So one of the benefits of an LLC is that it avoids double taxation, especially if you have profits and income. Secondly, for liability purposes, an LLC is treated as a good old-fashioned regular corporation if you follow the rules. So all of the owners who have an interest in the LLC, they avoid personal liability. So the LLC, indeed itself, has the liability. So if a judgment creditor comes along and sues the LLC, it doesn't sue the individual owners of the LLC. It sues the LLC and perhaps could obtain credit, could obtain some type of relief against the assets that the LLC holds. Now, unlike a corporation, we call owners in a corporation shareholders. We call owners in a partnership partners. In a limited liability company, we call the owners members. So the members control the LLC. It is a very, very popular way of holding real estate because the membership interest can be freely conveyed to other members. New members can be brought into the LLC. And because of the advantage of flow-through taxation, that's the big one, it avoids double taxation. So for apartment complexes, real estate, and even indeed some cases farmland and other forms of real estate, among a few investors or people, it is generally considered the optimum way of holding real estate. Similarly, you are going to see more and more service-type companies like lawyers, like accountants. They typically, instead of being incorporated, it will say David Sino, Attorney at Law, LLC, Limited Liability Company. So this vitiates the individual liability among myself as a member. So essentially, you would be able to sue the limited liability company. Presumably, the LLC has insurance in order to protect the assets as well. So if you go on, for example, in Illinois, the Secretary of State website, and you look at the various ways of setting up your business, you will see that you can file forms to be incorporated, you can file forms to be known as a partnership, and indeed you can file forms to become an LLC. If you file in the state of Illinois to become an LLC, the initial filing fee is $500 to set up an LLC in Illinois, and then you file an annual statement. Every LLC also needs a tax identification number. So at the same time, you then go to the IRS website, www.irs.gov, and you download what's called an SS4 form. That's the tax identification form, and you procure a tax identification number as well. It's really not very complicated, to be honest about it. The bottom line is it's great from a liability standpoint, and it's great because it's not subject to double taxation.
Oh, super. So how would that compare to a generation-skipping trust?
It has nothing to do with the generation-skipping trust. It's not part of an estate planning tool for the most part. What would happen is that you would title your LLC membership, possibly, if you have an LLC membership, the member could be David Sino Individual. It could be David Sino Revocable Living Trust. It could be David Sino Generation Skipping Trust. So in other words, it's just like holding any other asset. It's how you title it. And that gets a bit more complex, and you would need a sophisticated estate planning attorney to advise you on that matter.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much.
Very good. Let's go to line number two, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello, David. Hi, David.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions about I-bonds for inflation protection. The first one is you can buy one of these a year. Are those calendar years, or do you have to wait a year from when you bought the last one?
Well, actually, no, it's calendar year, and you have a certain volume maximum that you can buy.
Right. Now, the second question
yes.
is, would you buy them before or after May 1st? The rates change May 1st. Now, since you can actually buy $5,000 from a bank and another $5,000 online,
correct,
from Treasury direct, would you do one before and one after?
Absolutely. Oh. Let's dollar cost average. I'm not a soothsayer. I'm not a I don't have a crystal ball.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I would do.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Very good. And next, Bloomington, Indiana is the caller here. Line number four. Hello.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. My first question is about some comments you made at the top of the show about the Federal Reserve lowering mortgage rates. And it is true that the Federal Reserve made mortgage rates even more attractive than they had been. But mortgage rates had already been very attractive before the Federal Reserve lowered them even more.
Correct.
And they had not attracted customers then. Why will lowering the mortgage rates a little more make the customers come now?
Okay, a couple of things. Actually, the Federal Reserve doesn't directly lower mortgage rates. What happens is that mortgage rates are typically tied to the 10-year Treasury. They usually trade about 2 to 2.5% greater than the 10-year Treasury. And through Fed action, interest rates on long-term Treasuries are coming down. Hence, the mortgage rates will follow. Now, actually, there is a tremendous amount of loan activity going on in the pipeline at the very moment. In fact, most mortgage lenders and underwriters are just besieged with business, as it turns out, and they are running far, far behind in processing loans. The difference is that the loans they are processing at the current time are not necessarily new loans on new home purchases, but these are refinancing loans that are clogging up the system at the current time. In fact, there is so much refinancing activity that is going on that as a result, there is so much demand that interest rates and mortgage rates really haven't come down as much as predicted. So someone is still, you know, picking off profits in the system because of so much demand for refinancing. A lot of specialists in this business feel that mortgage rates today should be somewhere between at least 0.25% lower than they are today, but for the tremendous amount of refinancing business that is taking place in the pipeline. So the underwriters don't feel any pressure, if you will, to actually give us the interest rates that we really should be receiving based upon where the 10-year Treasury is trading. And so you're right, we haven't seen this big spur of new purchase and home activity. What we're seeing is a huge amount of refinancing activity taking place. And whether or not an $8,000 freebie for first-time home purchasers, along with these low interest rates, are going to spur at least first-time home purchasers to step up to the plate at the current time. That, of course, presumes that they have a stable job, which,
yeah,
of course, is another issue as we see month after month after month continued job erosion in our economy. It's reported currently at somewhere over 8%. But, of course, as I've mentioned on previous shows, if we add the people who have literally dropped out of the market and are no longer seeking a job, let alone people who are underemployed, that's called the PhD driving a cab, then the actual rate is well over 10%. So it's very, very difficult for a lot of people to jump into a home when they are actually concerned about their job.
I have another question about these AIG money managers who are getting these huge bonuses, $165 million. Now, these money managers did not make $165 million for AIG this past year, but it's got to be true that ordinarily they would be expected to make investments that would yield considerably over $165 million. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth paying them $165 million bonuses. So ordinarily, they have to make much more than $165 million. Wouldn't that be ordinary? Is that right?
Well, that would be right. And I don't want to get into a 15-minute analysis of AIG bonuses, but let me just point out a couple of things. A number of these bonuses, in fact, most of them, were guaranteed by contract. That's number one.
Yes.
Number two, in the financial services industry, most of the money that the players make in the financial services industry, once you get above middle management, to be honest about it, is bonus. The actual salary is maybe 5 to 10% of the overall compensation that these folks are expecting or have an expectation of. Now, maybe that's a ludicrous amount of money for you and I, and we feel that that is very unfair, but nevertheless, that's the way things have been done for an awful long time. So, one, these have been legally agreed to by contract. Whether or not we feel that these are reasonable or not, that's a whole other question. And whether or not this should be paid out of TARP money, we all agree that that's pretty darn outrageous. And it appears that Congress is so peeved, along with the American public, that they are going to pass, the House has already passed, a 90% excise tax, 90% on any bonuses that were received by these AIG folks. And it looks like this may even spread to other bonuses that were paid out of TARP money to some of these other banks and financial institutions. Now, AIG would argue, on the other hand, that these people are important to protect because they control large shares of business for AIG. And if we don't pay for these folks, then someone else is going to take them away. And when they leave AIG, they're also going to take their business with them, because this kind of business is very, very personal. It's very relationship-oriented. So I think the AIG argument is that we need to pay these folks to keep them on the payroll so that we protect our basic lines of business. Now, we could argue about that all day long, whether that is sound thinking, unsound thinking, but that is at least the line of thinking that AIG is articulating, not only to the American public, but to Congress, et cetera. Nevertheless, it appears, and David, you've probably followed this story closer than I do even, that this excise tax business is likely to pass both houses of Congress, and basically those bonuses are going to be expunged. They're going to be regurgitated, if you will, back into the coffers one way or another.
Well, it seems to me as soon as you offer these money managers as soon as you contract with them for these kinds of bonuses, this kind of high pay, that it makes it inevitable that they are going to take excessive risks the way they did, because they have a huge amount of pressure on them to make money for the company.
Agreed.
And so they've got to take into their calculation somewhere that AIG is too big to fail. And if they take too big a risk and they lose money for the company and they virtually go bank, as they did, bankrupt, then the federal government is going to come in and bail them out, and that has to be in their calculus, and it makes their bankruptcy inevitable, because they are just going to take risks. They're under such pressure to take risks. They're going to take risks, and pretty soon those risks are going to, they're going to backfire, and what happened is going to happen.
Yeah, and I'm not disagreeing with you, and that's often referred to as moral hazard in the financial and insurance industry. And that's exactly what was taking place here. And now a lot of economists are feeling, it might have been better for AIG to have gone through the bankruptcy system and the government stepped in and protected the essential lines of business and let the non-essential lines be sold off. It probably would have been a lot less expensive in hindsight, and certainly not more debilitating for the American economy. So your points are well taken. Thank you so much for bringing them up.
Yeah. We're past our midpoint here, and I hope the caller won't mind if I go on. We have some other folks who have been waiting here, and I want to give them a chance to talk with our guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management issues. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Champaign and on line three. Hello.
Hi. Vanguard, the tips compared to, let's say, if you get government tips, but the risk factor is something like two. What in other words, why is there? I would assume that it'd be at a one or the lowest level, the Vanguard.
Oh, because remember that any type of fixed income instrument is subject to interest rate risk. So as a result, because it is treated as a fixed income investment, that the principal value can change based upon the direction of interest rates.
Okay.
Now, that's the real reason. But as you can see, they have been a handsome investment this year. And in fact, even for my own clients, I've been sort of sitting on the sidelines waiting to pull the trigger and perhaps dollar cost averaging in with their cash if you believe that there is going to be substantial inflation down the road. And, of course, with more and more money sloshing around in the economy, we all know that ultimately there has to be more inflation. The question is when. Is that in the next 6 months, 9 months, year, 2 years, etc.? But if you are a long-term player, a long-term holder, and you are willing to dollar cost average in, I don't have any problem with your holding tips.
Now, the other one is there's no difference then between the government, the strictly government one and the one in the Vanguard, right?
Yeah, because that's what Vanguard uses. If you go online, you'll see that 99% of that is really government paper.
Now, the other one is that when you say year to date, that's for 2009, right?
Yes, absolutely. That was through yesterday's close.
Right. But in other words, it's still, if you consider last year, it's still down maybe, 40% or something?
Oh, at least. Well, it's actually down more. If you lost 40% last year on your portfolio and then you lost 12 or 14% this year, so you're really down probably more like 45% if you actually looked at an asset allocation.
Okay. So I got it just quickly, a couple. Yours is all indexed, right? Your portfolio?
For the stock part of the portfolio, I'm just giving you these eight stock indexes, yes.
And if you can, what's the other big one that's in Vanguard, and what's the other one that's like Vanguard?
Fidelity?
Well, there are a number of companies that do index. You have, for example, Fidelity has four or five indexes. You can go to any of the major brokerage firms and access indexes. And alternatively, you can go to any brokerage firm, including Vanguard, and you can purchase ETFs, which are exchange-traded funds, and they're basically a tracking stock. They're a stock that tracks an index. So it's a matter of pick your poison, so to speak.
Well, Fidelity, the only difference is, isn't it a little bit higher in terms of what their charge is?
Well, Fidelity doesn't have the range of mutual fund indexes, but their fees on the ones they have are fairly competitive with Vanguard. They've been forced, if you will, to be very, very competitive with Vanguard.
And then finally, I heard in terms of the GMP, our GMP, that in terms of the money, how does that work? In terms of what's happened is that at one time, it was only a small percentage in terms of capital or something or other, that how much money was out there. Now we're about 150% more. Is that right or something or other?
Well, are you referring to GDP?
Right.
Gross domestic product, which is about $14 trillion currently. And you could compare that to M1 or M2. M1 is just cash sloshing around and demand deposits. And to be honest about it, I don't have those percentages.
Okay.
But there's no question that the money supply is dramatically increasing.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Next up, we'll talk with someone on our line number two, and I believe this would be someone in Decatur. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Quick question. Last year, I took a distribution out of my IRA in the form of stock to transfer it over into my normal account in order to take advantage of a low price of the stock. That way, when I take it out, I'm not taking as much, not going to pay as much tax. And when the stock does climb up, I'll be able to take long-term capital gains.
That's good thinking.
The question I have is, once I've done that, I took a sizable portion of stock out, in the form, in monetarily wise, it's worth quite a bit of money. Once I start an IRA distribution, do I have to take it every year, or can I just shut it down and not take IRA distributions for a year or two? Because my tax accountant did not know.
Okay, well, number one, as it turns out, this particular year in 2009, there is a special rule, and you don't have to take any IRA distributions.
Well, this was 2008 that I took the distribution.
Okay, in 2008... obviously, whatever you took out in terms of fair market value, was this a traditional IRA that you pulled it out of?
Yes.
Okay. So let's say you pulled out $25,000 just for round numbers to make it easy. That $25,000 is going to be reported on your 2008 income tax return.
Correct.
As ordinary income.
That's right.
All right? Now, in that position, in that stock, you now have a $28,000 tax basis. All right?
Okay.
So let's say that later on, or $25,000 tax basis. Right. Let's say that you sold it later on for $50,000. Okay.
Right.
Then you have a $25,000 capital gain.
Capital gain.
And you want to make sure that you have long-term capital gain.
Exactly.
So you want to hold it for a year and a day, and then you'll have long-term capital gain, and then whatever the capital gains rate is, you'll pay it capital gains rate. Currently, that's a 15% federal rate.
Right.
But, of course, in the proposed administrative tax changes, that may well go up.
Correct.
So we'll have to see.
But
all right.
But my question is, once I've taken
how old are
distributions,
you?
Do I have to take any more for a year or two? Or
how old are you? How old are you?
66.
No. The general rule is that you are not required to take any distributions until the April 1 after you reach 70 and a half.
Okay, yeah.
So you can wait till 70 and a half. You don't have to take any more distributions.
Go.
And that's what I would recommend unless you need the money.
Thanks a bunch. AIG, arrogant, incompetent, greedy.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We are moving into about our last 15 minutes here in this first hour of Focus 580 with David Sinnoh. We have got callers. We'll try to get as many as we can.
David, there's some emotion out there today.
I guess, as if we didn't know. Next is someone in Morris, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm thinking about taking all my funding, all my money out of the stock market that I have and just putting it in a bank and saying, forget this, because I've lost pretty much everything that I had in my 401k. So whatever I've got left, I'm actually thinking about pulling that out, only for the fact that everything that I've seen and listened to people say, it isn't bottomed out yet, and I can't wait. I can't go down to nothing. I have no money as it is. So,
how old are you?
52. I can't find a job because they say I'm too old. They're looking for kids that are out of college. You know, nobody's hiring. I shouldn't say I can't find a job. I just found one at $9 an hour mowing grass for a park district because there's nothing out there. And my college degree is in forestry, which, you know, the environmentalists killed that years ago. So, I mean, I don't know why everybody's talking about, you know, I think people ought to be saving, to be honest with you. Stick it in the bank. Let it collect interest to the banks that are solvent. Because I don't see the bottom. I mean, until we get there, I don't know why everybody's talking stocks.
Well, let me give you my take on things, and obviously your story is not unlike literally millions of stories that are out there where people in their 401ks have lost as much as 50% of their money, and some people jokingly refer to their 401k now as a 201k because they have lost half of their money, and I'm not making light of it at all or of your situation. It's extraordinarily serious. What I will say is that if you are going to make any changes in your 401k, do it inside your 401k. If you suddenly shut down your 401k, take the money out of your 401k, all of that money is going to be subject to federal income tax, plus, since you're under 59 and a half, an additional 10% penalty. That would be ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are going to make a change and you're going to move out of stocks, then move from stocks to, say, a money market or CDs or whatever is available to you in your 401k, but do it inside your 401k. That's number one. That's number one.
Real quick, and I'll get off. Real quick, do you see this as an upswing or a downswing? Do you see the economy and everything picking up? stock market-wise, and do you think what I'm thinking about doing is a wise idea or, you know, and no, I'll get
okay.
off. That's all. Thanks.
Okay. Number one, don't get out of your 401k. Whatever you do, do it inside your 401k. If this is too gut-wrenching for you, then make a 50% bet. Move 50% of your 401k money into some type of fixed income like a money market, a CD, inside your 401k. Let the other 50% continue to ride. Because, again, based on your age of 52, you really aren't supposed to even access this money until 59 and a half. That's 7.5 years. Do I believe that stocks will be higher 7.5 years from than they are today? Yes, I do. I firmly believe that. Could I be wrong? Yes, I could be dead wrong about that, but that's what I believe based upon my reading of 80 or 90 years of stock market history. So I think it's a mistake, if you can't access that money anyway, to access it, number one, and then two, to jettison the whole portfolio when I believe we are closer to historic lows than we are to historic highs. Something else for 401k investors who need money. Check to find out whether or not your 401k program allows you to borrow money out of your 401k as opposed to taking a distribution out of your 401k. And then if you borrow it out, you can pay it back at what are really very historically low rates, which is the prime rate, which is about 3.25% today. And you can pay it back by amortizing it over 60 months. So for those of you who need money, are in a 401k program, check with your plan sponsor to see if you could borrow some money out. And the general rule is you can borrow out as much as half of your 401k money or $50,000, whichever is less. But for goodness sake, just don't take a premature distribution, because then you got to pay income tax on it and you got to pay a 10% penalty. That would be a tragedy.
All right. Well, hope that helps. Let's go next to Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm.
Time to be fishing, Mr. Sinnoh.
It certainly is, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity. I hope I addressed the question that you asked last time.
Yes, sir, you did. The thing I wanted to bring up, and many people seem to miss, is AIG means American Insurance Group. International group, it means also it does a lot of insurance. And $165 million to these players is really small potatoes. The serious amount of our money is going towards making banks in Germany and France and England and Holland and Spain and the United States, making them whole for their losses. That's where the true billions are going.
No question.
And people don't seem to really understand that these people took risk, but they're not. They took risk, and then they're not paying for the not paying the consequences for the risk they took. They took insurance. Who people were writing insurance that was just ridiculous.
Well, what they were actually doing is AIG has insurance divisions. Interestingly enough, you may have your automobile, your home, your apartment, your warehouse insured by AIG, but they had a whole nother division that were writing what are called credit default swaps or derivative contracts. They kind of acted like insurance. And so when a bank in Germany or Deutsche Bank, for example, held these tremendous amount of mortgage-backed securities, maybe they were U.S. mortgage-backed securities, they bought insurance. They bought credit default swaps from AIG, which said, hey, if these go down in value, you got to bail us out. And when AIG couldn't contractually bail these banks out based upon legal contracts that AIG had entered into, guess who came to their rescue? The gentleman from Belgium, the gentleman at WILL who runs this program, David Sinnoh, and all of us.
Exactly.
That's what happened. Why did we agree to bail these folks out? Because everyone relies on the financial integrity of the U.S. system. And the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and the top people in the government clearly felt that we had to do this to avoid a complete financial world global meltdown. That's the bottom line here.
But I just don't understand why the individuals who contracted this thing shouldn't be as...
be liable.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, number one, they didn't understand the bet they were making.
Oh.
And number two, interestingly enough, you're now hearing at congressional hearings going on this very moment while we are on the air, you're hearing about, well, was there fraud? Was there criminal liability here? So now you're starting to hear, and that would grieve me greatly, and that would get me very concerned if I was one of the gentlemen or ladies who were entering into these huge, huge derivative bets. But you know, some of the smartest people in the world lost billions on these bets, including the famous Warren Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
He made derivative bets through Berkshire Hathaway, and Berkshire Hathaway lost billions. The difference is that Berkshire Hathaway used their own capital, for goodness sake, to pay off these bad bets.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's see. Next, we'll talk with someone in Muhammad, line three. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We have money in AIG annuity, and are told by AIG that that annuity is safe, but I'm not sure I believe that.
Well, let me ask you a question. What is the value of the annuity greater than $100,000?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question for a lot of reasons. We have something. Are you an Illinois resident?
Yes.
Okay. We have something in Illinois called the Illinois Health and Life Guarantee Fund. That's a state statutory enacted fund which protects holders of cash value life insurance and annuities, at least in Illinois, up to $100,000 of value. So we have a backup from the state of Illinois if you believe in the financial integrity of the state of Illinois, up to $100,000. Is it possible that AIG could ultimately declare bankruptcy? Is that still a possibility? I suppose. And could you be a judgment creditor of AIG? I suppose that's possible as well. I don't think that's going to happen because of the tremendous amounts of money that have been poured into AIG, plus their insurance and their annuity divisions are actually profitable. So as a result, it's a tough call. Now, one of the things that you can do is you can do what is called a like-kind exchange. You could actually take your annuity money and have it transferred to another insurance group, and you would have no tax impact. The problem is that you might be paid a different interest rate, and if you took your money out early, there might be premature withdrawals. What I would do is I would contact the agent who you did business with and discuss whether or not it might make sense to do what is called a like-kind exchange. That would be the conversation I would have with my insurance agent and or my financial advisor.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, hope that that helps. So we'll go and get at least one more caller, and this would be Champagne in line two. Hello.
Hi, I think that's me. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Hi. I am wondering if this would be a good time to convert some money held in a Roth IRA that's in Fidelity Cash Reserves right now into a inflation-protected fund, a TIPS fund, a mutual fund. I was thinking of the Vanguard one. I don't know that Fidelity has one. But would that be a good move at this time to start some...
averaging in?
Yes.
Yeah. So let me understand. You're currently in a Roth IRA, and in your Roth IRA, your money is basically in Fidelity Cash Reserves, which is a money market account.
Yes.
Okay. I think you can stay at Fidelity. You can call Fidelity. And they do have, I believe, a Treasury Inflation Protected Securities Mutual Fund. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look it up because I really don't use that fund, but I'm guessing they have that fund. And if so, you could dollar cost average. I wouldn't throw all my money in at one time. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it would be a bad idea to say, gee, I think I'm going to put aside 50% of my money and invest that in Treasury inflation protected securities and do that over the next 6 to 18 months. That might be a strategy for you to do, but don't liquidate your Roth IRA.
Right.
So let's say that you had $10,000 in your Roth.
Right.
And you're thinking, gee, I'd like to invest $5,000 in TIPS.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to invest that all at once.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to invest it over the next 6, 12, 18 months. So mm-hmm. once a month I invest,
right.
that's how I would do it.
And you think it's a Fidelity Treasury?
It's called Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, TIPS,
and
T-I-P-S.
A good time to make that move?
Well, again, I'm not a prognosticator,
mm-hmm.
so I would rather do it over a series
right.
of months. Because
right.
I think ultimately down the road we are going to see higher inflation, but I don't
mm-hmm.
think we're going to see it in the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I think you could start averaging in.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll try to get real quick. One more. Sycamore, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I heard you talking to someone who had stocks in their IRA earlier, and it occurred to me that this may not be such a good idea because the long-term capital gains you may realize are then eventually wind up being taxed at full tax rates for ordinary income. Am I right?
No, not exactly. Not exactly. What happens is that if you take money out of an IRA, and you can take it out in cash or you can take it out in stock, you get taxed on it. If you have it in stock, that's your basis. If you hold that stock for a long period of time and then sell it, you're going to have a capital gain. And historically, capital gains tax rates have always been lower than the highest ordinary income tax rates. So I think that's still a good bet that regardless, you'd rather pay at capital gains tax rates than ordinary income tax rates, even if capital gains rates go up some.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Well, at that, I think we're just about at the point we have to finish up. Any last thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, David, first of all, it's a testament to our listening audience for the kinds of questions that they ask. We have a very sophisticated listening audience and a very, very, what shall I say, they're well-informed. They're intellectually well-informed, they're socially well-informed, they're politically well-informed. And that, of course, is a testament in some senses, David, to you and the wonderful programming at WILL. So I want to wish all of the listening audience a good weekend, and let's all hope that our investments start to go north. They kind of head in the right direction. And thanks for once again providing me the opportunity to be here on this program.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. David Sinnoh is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a tax referendum that's going to be on the ballot for people in Urbana in April. This would be an increasing property taxes to benefit the Urbana Park District, and we'll have two guests, the executive director of the Park District and the president of the board, to hear to talk about that and to take your questions. That's coming up in just a little bit. First, though, we have an update in the markets and news, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Well, after what has been a relatively high volatile week, we're seeing a much more subdued trade to end this week. Let's go ahead and go right to the marketplace and check in on prices in Kansas City. May wheat at 596 down 10, now down 10 and a quarter. July 606 and three quarters down 10. September 614 and three quarters down 11 and three quarters. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 545 and a quarter down 10. July 557 and a half down 10 and a quarter. September 582 down 9 and 3 quarters. May corn 395 and 3 quarters down 3 quarters. July 406 down 1. September 415 and a quarter down 1. December 427 and a half down 3 quarters. March of 2010 438 and a half down 3 quarters. April crude oil goes off the board today. It's at 51.35. down 26 cents. The April Arbob 144 and 2 tenths, and it is up 5/10. May beans, 9:45 and a half up 5, July.